This is episode 456 of Wheel Bearings. I am Sam Abul Salmon from Telemetry.
And I'm Roberto Baldwin from SAE International.
And we are in the midst of day one of Operation Frodo EV 2026, possibly the first and possibly the only all-electric edition of Operation Frodo.
I think things are going fine. Just the one little boo-boo. And it was only a hiccup.
So you may notice here behind us here, that's Theodore. And we've also got Simon and Alvin and Tootsie in the far back. We are currently driving across, we just left Ogallala, Nebraska from our second charging stop of the day. We are in the middle of transporting 16 rescue dogs, taking them from Omaha, where we started off the morning, and we will end up in Portland on Wednesday. And we are currently in a Kia EV9. We've got a convoy of four EVs that we're using. We've got this EV9. Behind us is a Hyundai Ioniq 9. We also have a Cadillac Escalade IQ that I drove from my home in Ypsilanti, Michigan, to Omaha on Friday and Saturday. It's about 720 miles. That one is getting its battery replenished right now as we speak. And we've also got a Lucid Gravity. And so far we've only had one minor hiccup. We thought we might have lost the Ioniq 9.
All the lights came on.
It showed all the hallmarks of a blown integrated charge control unit. Basically, all the warning lamps were on. It said electrical system failure. We could not get it to start or do anything. Fortunately, Harvey Briggs, who's one of our crew, he had some tools with him because he's actually going back. Harvey lives in Madison. He's going back. Boy, that was a close call with that bird.
We almost hit a bird. Harvey, I'm not even speeding. I'm actually going under the speed limit. Bird's all, yeah!
Harvey is buying a vintage BMW motorcycle from our friend Jeff Gersmead, Jeff lives in Oregon, and he's going to ride that back from Oregon all the way back to Wisconsin after we're done with this trip. So he brought some tools along with him just in case. You know, he probably won't need them, but, you know, at least, you know, it's an analog bike, so who knows what's going to happen. You know, at least it'll be fairly easy to fix.
A long trip, especially with an older bike, you should always just have a wrap of tools.
Yeah, just some wrenches, you know.
Yeah.
Things just like that. Screwdrivers.
You know, it's always good to have.
Yeah, you never know what you're going to need. So, we've covered about 400 miles, I think, so far today. Aside from that little boo-boo with the I never did finish telling you what happened with the Ioniq. Yeah.
It's like a cliffhanger. Tune in to our next episode. It's like, who shot JR?
I got talking about the tools and forgot about the Hyundai. We pulled the cover off the 12-volt battery and disconnected that. Using Harvey's one of Harvey's wrenches, waited a minute, reconnected it. Car still wouldn't start up, so we reached out to Hyundai. We thought maybe the ICCU was dead and it was going to be stranded. Would have to be put on a flatbed and taken hundreds of miles to a dealer somewhere to get repaired. So Harvey and Nick Miles, who's the leader of this crew, found a car rental place about 30 miles back, the opposite direction we were going. They went to rent a car just in case, because we have 16 dog kennels that we were transporting and all the stuff. Shortly after they left to go get the rental car, our other friend, Paul Eisenstein, hit the stop start button in the Hyundai one more time, and all of a sudden it powered right back up again like nothing was wrong.
It's like, it's ready to rock.
Yeah.
And then we stopped again and we charged, and that's where the problem ended up last time. No, it's right behind us now.
Yeah.
No issues, just
it's all good.
You know, like a little hiccup, it's like, ha ha. Because you can't have a story without drama, and you can't have any sort of road trip without some sort of side quest adventure. And that was our side quest adventure Just actually hanging out with dogs in a parking lot and eating Subway.
Yeah, exactly. And this last charging stop, we also had a not a full blown crisis, but just a minor hiccup with the Kia and the Hyundai arrived first, and we got in, plugged in, charged. We were cranking along 230 kilowatts. It was an Electrify America station where we had four chargers, two of which are 150s, two or 350 kilowatt chargers. And we plugged these two into the 350 kilowatt chargers. They charged up real quickly. But then the Cadillac arrived about 10 minutes behind us, plugged into one of the 150 chargers, but it wouldn't charge over 60 kilowatts. So when we were done charging...
Well, no, it got to 61 a few times.
Oh, sorry, yes. Okay, sorry. 61 was the peak. So once we got... once we finished with the charging the Hyundai up to 90%, we moved that one out of the way, moved the Cadillac over to that charging stall, plugged in, and it was still only going 60, 61 kilowatts, even on a 350 kilowatt charger. And I charged it the other day at 350 kilowatts without any problem at all. So I don't know what the issue was. Well, I think we know what the issue was.
We know what the issue was.
Yeah, because there were two cables on there. We unplugged that cable, plugged in the other one.
Same unit, not a different unit. We just unplugged one cable, plugged in the other.
270 kilowatts right off the bat.
So you're fearing, what's the name of this town again?
Ogallala.
If you're in Ogallala and you're on charger number three, use the cable on the left.
Correct.
The cable on the right is not getting proper cooling. And when the charging station, when the cables don't get proper cooling, they limit them to like 75 kilowatts or something.
Or 61.
Yeah. Apparently 61 now.
Yeah. So
use the cable on the left.
So there, and the Gravity, when it got there a few minutes later, it plugged into the other 350 kilowatt charger. It was going at 350 kilowatts, no problem at all. That one was working fine. So yeah, if you're using charger number three at the EA station at the Walmart in Ogallala, Nebraska, use the cable on the left.
Cable on the right, no bueno.
Yeah. Right now we are on our way to Cheyenne, Wyoming, where we'll be spending the night tonight, before moving on to Salt Lake City tomorrow. But let's get into some of the stuff that's been going on, the usual stuff that we talk about. So did you drive anything this past week?
I did, but I'm not going to have notes or information other than I drove the car and I really liked it.
Just give us your general impression.
There we go. So I got the Kia K4, wagon. Hatchback, whatever they want to call it. It's a little station wagon, and I loved it. It's, you know, it's not fast, it's not powerful. I got the GT line, so it's like the fastest powerful. If you use the paddle shifters, it's fun in the mountains, it's fun on the twisties. It's front wheel drive, so you know, it's front wheel drive, so you got that going for you. But overall, I love that car because it's a wagon, but also, you know, it's a good little Kia.
It's a little mini wagon.
Mini wagon. There's plenty of space. I put stuff in it. I went and bought dog food with it. I did other things with it. Dog food, it's a giant bag. So I had to buy a bunch of stuff. I put it in the back of the car. I've been driving it around all week. When I fly back to the Bay Area tomorrow night, I'm doing half of the Operation Frodo. It'll be waiting for me at the little parking place at the airport. And I'm delighted and I'm a little sad it'll be going away on Tuesday. But yeah, Kia K4 station wagon. I believe it starts at like 24 for the station, for the hatchback. It's more expensive than the regular one, than the regular K4, the sedan.
But it's worth it for that better looking back end and the extra utility.
Yeah, you can put more stuff in the back. It's not, you know, it's not a huge vehicle, but I feel it's the low cost gas vehicle that America needs right now. That's what I've decided. Because everyone, like, we gotta get a crossover, we gotta get this, and it's nice, it's low slung. It's a proper car. It does have the weird, we're driving the EV9 right now, where the climate controls are being obstructed by the steering wheel. The K4 has that as well.
Yeah, it has the exact same screen, same steering wheel.
I don't know why kids thought that was a great idea. Anyway, so I can see what our temperatures are, but everything else is a bit obstructed.
Kia's been making really great cars for the last several years, but it seems like on every one of these great cars, there's got to be one strange little quirk in the ergonomics.
Yeah, it can't.
That,
yeah, Like, we can't make, you can't make perfection, because perfection would, but then would they toy they would, with the universe.
They would so never have anything to aim for.
Yeah. You won't have anything to aim for the next one, for the refresh.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Kia K4, station wagon. Again, I don't have the specs or anything with me because I'm driving, and...
You had the GT line, the turbo?
I had the GT
line.
So
it's about 190, 195 horsepower.
Yeah,
that's fine. Eight-speed automatic transmission.
So many speeds. I was using the paddle shifters, and it just kept going up and up and up and up and up. And, you know, in the back road, you're like third and fourth gear. And I was just like, what is that? How many speeds has this thing got? Eight, ocho. Yeah. So, if, you know, anything above five is just various types of overdrive at this point. But, yeah, Kia K4. Wagon. What else can I say? It's comfortable. I sit in the back seat, tall person behind tall person, probably not a great idea. But I think it's a great car if you're you're not a bunch of basketball players and you just need a nice, inexpensive, good car, and you don't wanna join team crossover.
Did you know you can support Wheel Bearings directly? Head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia and you can become a patron today. Your contributions will help fund the platforms and tools we use to bring the podcast to you. And exclusives and improvements are already on the way thanks to your generosity. So if you want to be part of an automotive podcast like no other, head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia. We've updated the Wheel Bearings merch store, and now there's a whole bunch of new choices, new colors, new styles, t-shirts, sweatshirts, hoodies, hats, mugs, travel mugs, stickers, aprons, tote bags, you name it. You can get your Wheel Bearings merch at shop.wheelbearings.media. Go check it out. That's shop.wheelbearings.media.
All right. I also had a non-crossover this past week. I had the Honda Prelude, the new Prelude. And, you know, to everybody that's been hating on this thing because it's a hybrid, get over it. Just, you know, get over it. I think, you know, this is a great-looking car, great-looking little coupe. Yeah, because the thing is, the Prelude, in its first five generations, it was never a sports car. It was always a sporty coupe. And that's exactly what this car is. It is a sporty coupe. But it's a fairly quick sporty coupe. It's got Honda's hybrid system in there, the same system that's in the CRV, the Accord, the Civic, 200 horsepower, 232 foot-pounds of torque, and it's got their S Plus sport, you know, simulated shifting system in there. That's also going to be coming to the at least to the Civic. I don't know about the other models, but because you know, the way Honda's hybrid system is configured, it does most of the work with the electric motor. So unlike most Toyota hybrids that do most of the work with the gas engine and, you know, have a relatively smaller electric motor, this thing, out of that 200 horsepower, 181 horsepower is coming from the electric motor. And then there's 140 horsepower, 2-liter, 4-cylinder. It works more like Nissan's the e-Power system. It works most of the time. It's working as a series hybrid, and the engine is just driving the second motor as a generator, and the 181 horsepower motor is driving the car. And then at higher speeds, higher load conditions, there's a clutch that will, under those certain conditions, will engage the engine and send a little bit of the engine torque to the wheels. But it works really smoothly. It's, you know, much in general, much quieter, much more refined feeling, and it drives more like an EV, which is good. But in the case of the Prelude, because it's a sporty car, they gave it a little more engine noise. The way they're controlling the engine is more, they're controlling it. They're doing simulated shifting, so revving the engine up and down to correspond to simulated shifts, kind of like a Hyundai Ioniq 5N, but it's not as loud as the Hyundai. Which is funny because the Hyundai is all electric and it's much louder inside than the Prelude, which is a hybrid, where you're actually hearing an actual engine. You know, and it's not really simulated noise. It's actual engine noise that you're hearing. You know, and you're hearing the engine rev up and down as you, when you put it in sport mode and hit the S Plus button, you tap the paddles and it simulates shifting. You know, so it's revving the engine as if you were, as if it was connected to an 8-speed transmission and shifting. But you know, it just it's actually a lot of fun to drive, especially because it has the suspension and the brakes from the Civic Type R. So, you know, Honda says they're not going, they have no plans to ever do a Prelude Type R, which is fine, you know, but
don't really need to. Yeah, it's a niche car. Why make it nichier?
Exactly. So, you know, this is a great car. And if you must have a Prelude Type R, Honda sells a Type R crate engine. You can buy a Type R engine direct from Honda in a box. And because the front structure of this thing is basically the front end of a Civic, it'll bolt right in there. And you can get the 6-speed automatic or 6-speed manual transmission from a Type R. All those parts will fit in this car. And I would be shocked if this November at SEMA, if there isn't at least one company that has built a Prelude Type R from a Honda crate engine. But like I said, you don't really need it. It's got great, the front seats are great. They're very supportive. You know, there's only a couple of adjustments, basically fore aft, height, and the seat back angle. You know, not a lot of fancy stuff. Keep it simple. The back seat, if you're no more than about 3.5-4 feet tall, you can fit back there. Other than that, you don't want to sit in the back seat. The best thing to do with the back seat, just fold it down. You got a big hatchback in the rear. You got lots of cargo space. You know, I put my dog seat cover down across the back. And, you know, when I took my dog to the vet earlier this week, and he was fine back there. You know, strapped him in. He was perfect. So he had lots of room. So the Civic, the Honda Prelude, the one I had was in the I think it's. Deep blue, no, not deep blue. I forget, it's some shade of blue. It's a lighter shade of blue that looks really good.
Like a robin's egg blue?
It's darker than a robin's egg.
Okay.
But not like a real dark blue. So it's kind of a distinct color. It looks fantastic. I like it. I like the way this car looks. I really like the way it drives. The chassis, the suspension, really good because, you know, like I said, it's all Type R hardware under there. So, you know, when you're going into a corner, you can trail brake this thing into a corner, feels really good. You can, you know, have the back end, you know, just, you know, you can manipulate the back end with your foot on the brake and the accelerator. And it's just a lot of fun to drive. And like I said, you can simulate manual shifting with the paddles. And it's an easy car to drive around, but it's a lot of fun. It's not cheapest car. In large part because of the fact that it has all those Type R suspension and brake components on there. So it's $42,000. There's only one real option on there. They have what they call a two-tone, which has a black painted roof. You don't really need it. Just get the base model. And 42 grand, you know, that's about 5 grand cheaper than a Civic Type R. It's, you know, a little more than a Civic Sport hybrid. So it's like right in between those two. And by, you know, like I said, not inexpensive, but by today's standards, it's fairly reasonable.
I'm hearing from a lot of automotive journalists that have driven it recently who are like, I really liked it. I haven't driven it, so I don't know.
Yeah.
But I'm hearing from the rumbling from the rest of the other automotive journalists that I talked to is that they also really enjoyed the car a lot. So. Yeah, I think, you know, it came out, and I think people sort of kind of forgot what the Prelude was. It was never a sports car. It was never an S2000. It was never, you know, it's like getting angry if the Del Sol came out and, like, it didn't have a powerful engine. I owned a Del Sol. It did not have a powerful engine.
No.
But it was nice to drive around, and there was a lot of leg room. There was a ton of room in that little car, and it was great that you could put you take the hard top off, and they had a little holder in the trunk that only used up like this much trunk space, so you could still put all your stuff in it. It was a really nicely engineered vehicle. But if they bring it back and it doesn't have power, don't get angry about that because it never had power. People called it the Del Slow for a reason.
Yeah.
It was not a quick car, but it was an enjoyable car.
So the color I had is Boost Blue is the color. They also have it in race red, and there's a gray, a black, and a white. But get either the red or the Boost Blue.
Yeah, the Boost Blue, that looks pretty.
Yeah.
Almost killed us, but I looked at their, I looked at your screen.
All right, let's move on to some other stuff. Let's see. Oh, the Mercedes CLA. You've driven the CLA, right?
Yes, I've driven the hybrid extensively, and I've driven the electric vehicle for a little while. The electric one is better.
Period. Yeah, as is usually the case when you have those options. Edmunds just had a CLA 350 EV, and they have their standard EV range test that they do with all the cars that they test. The CLA 350 is rated at 312 miles range by the EPA. Guess how much? Guess how far Edmunds went with this thing?
320 something? 340.
385. They beat the EPA range number by 73 miles.
So when you do your EPA numbers, there's like there's two different ways to do it. Like Lucid and Tesla both do one way, so it sort of gooses their numbers a bit, while everyone else kind of does a different way. And typically the Germans and the Koreans, their vehicles typically beat EPA by a little bit.
Yeah.
And the U.S., like Ford, GM, those are usually like dead on.
Right.
Like they have, like, it's like, a Mach-E will be within like a few miles above the range. That is like ridiculous that it's so much higher than what the EPA number was. Like, did everyone just take a nap that day? Or did they forget to carry a one?
Pretty much, I think. I mean, driving that Escalade IQ from Detroit to Omaha, they claim 450 miles of range, I think, for that one. Because it's so heavy, it doesn't actually have an official EPA range number because it weighs over 9,000 pounds. But GM says it'll go about 450. And I went, when I stopped on Friday night to charge it, I had driven 370 miles and had, I think, 17 miles range left. It was showing about 50 miles. And that was all highway driving. So there was basically no city driving for that whole stretch. And I got, so that would have worked out to about 410-ish miles, 410, 415 miles, which is actually really good. Of course, you know, that thing has a 200 plus kilowatt hour battery
and
pack.
And wheels that are this big.
Yeah, that's on 24-inch wheels with... I was going through some of the setting screens, and there was a page for the tire pressure monitor. The tire pressures on that thing, on the front wheels, is 70 PSI, 79 PSI pressure on the rear wheels, on the rear tires. That's insane.
It's like jumbo jet numbers.
Yeah. Or, you know, like a semi. That's what semis use.
Because you have all that weight.
Yeah. That was 410, 415 miles with over 200 kilowatt hours of battery. You know, there's a lot less battery in this Mercedes CLA. The other thing that they did was they tested the charging capability. Again, Mercedes claims 320 kilowatt peak charging. They saw a peak of 349 kilowatts.
You're gonna make me spit out my drink. I mean, it's almost like the Disneyland effect. So if you go to Disneyland, I guess Disney World, I've never been to Disney World, but the plan was if you have a sign that says it'll be 45 minutes from this point, the reality is it'd be like 35 minutes or 40 minutes. It'd be less time than what they were telling you.
You want to under promise and over deliver.
So you feel like, oh my God, this line went so much quicker. Thank you, Disney people. And so this is like almost the same thing, I guess, where they're like, oh, it's only going to charge at 330, and then it charges like 450.
So at 349 kilowatts, you know, that works out to an effective charging speed of adding 654 miles of range per hour, which is pretty impressive.
I really like that CLA too.
Yeah.
I really like that car. It's really nice.
So hopefully I'll get a chance to drive one of these soon because it looks good and I'm looking forward to trying this one out. and seeing how far. Maybe, you know, well, it's too small really to use for Operation Frodo because we need space for the crates. But maybe when they have a, you know, a wagon or a crossover version on that platform. Is the new GLC?
GLC is on the,
okay.
Yeah.
So maybe a GLC.
I've only driven that in the sand, so I don't know how well that. So I've only driven it on sand dunes, which is a bonkers thing to say about an EV. So where'd you drive it? Sand dunes. What about in the road? Nope. Zero driving on the road, only on sand dunes outside of Las Vegas.
Sticking with EVs for a moment, our good friends at Stellantis, they announced pricing for the 2027 model year chargers. You know, and it's not unusual for pricing to, you know, to creep up a little bit year over year. That was certainly the case this year. So let's see, for the base Charger RT with the standard output Hurricane six cylinder, it actually stayed the same. Stayed unchanged for the base model. So for two-door, $49,995, four-door, $51,995. So you're paying $2,000 for the two extra doors. For the RT Plus, again, pricing stays the same. For the Charger Scat Pack, pricing also stays the same. Keep scrolling down the table here. Dodge Charger Daytona Scat Pack, 2026 model year, $59,995. 2027 model year, $72,495.
Where does $12,000, where did that money come from? What are you getting?
I mean, you know.
Does it come with another car? It comes with a late 2000s yeah. Voyager.
I mean, you know, it's such a hot selling car. You know, of course you got to raise the price. You know, when your car is popular. We're talking about the Charger Daytona. Never mind.
I don't, and I haven't driven the car. And everyone I know who has driven is like, it's not that bad.
Yeah.
But I really think to me, a muscle car makes the most sense for an EV because muscle cars go fast, straight line, the end.
Yeah.
But
definitely goes fast in a straight line.
And it makes noises. But, yeah. You know, it's like the large pickup truck. You know, full size pickup truck people want vroom vroom engine rah.
Yeah.
That's what muscle car people want. They want vroom vroom engine rah.
Well, and they
don't want to show up the cars and coffee with an electric muscle car.
They have the Fratsonic exhaust system. I was driving past one where was it in a parking lot the other day, and it was just sitting there idling. And you know, you could hear the rumbling, the rumbling.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's actually a pretty cool sound. I like it. But it's a great cruiser. You know, it's not a sports car, it's definitely a muscle car, but it's also great for just cruising on the like what we're doing here, driving across Nebraska. This is a straight level road that goes for about a million miles.
I can see the next states over.
There's South Dakota over there, and Colorado's down that way. And you can, if you look in the mirrors, you can still see Iowa back behind us.
It's so flat. As someone who's born and raised in California and lived in the mountains for a lot of that, it's a little unnerving.
Yeah.
Like I enjoy being able to see, like, off in a distance, a mountain range that'll protect me from invading, I don't know, hordes.
Let's delve into Tesla a little bit. So a couple of things. Tesla renamed full self-driving in China, only in China, because they got sued by a bunch of Chinese owners, taking it to court for misleading advertising, misleading marketing over the name full self-driving. Because in case you were wondering, Teslas are not actually capable of being fully autonomous without somebody sitting behind the wheel, keeping an eye on it, monitoring, or somebody, in Tesla's case, sitting remotely in a control center, watching the live video stream from the car and paying attention and taking over a remote control anytime, you know, when those, you know, it works really great a lot, most of the time, right up until it does something really terrible.
It works great until it doesn't, and then it doesn't, and then they're like, oh no. And you know, to be honest, like telepresence sort of, or tele, you know, control of of any self-driving vehicle on the, that's going to be a thing for a very long time.
Yeah.
Like, because there's always going to be something that confuses these vehicles. And so you need a person with a phone and be like, go left.
So Tesla, the FSD in China now, if you buy a Tesla in China, FSD is now called Tesla Assisted Driving. So
yeah,
if you're watching China, it's that's a perfectly appropriate name.
Yeah,
because that is exactly what it is. It's an assisted driving system.
I don't know why that they're fighting so hard against the just saying it's assisted driving when that's what it does.
Yeah. And then there was one other story related to FSD. There was a Reuters piece this week. They interviewed 10 people who, until relatively recently, were working on FSD, working on training and annotation of the data. Of those, 7 of those people said, I wouldn't trust FSD to drive me around. So, not good. Apparently, the data, the video clips that they get back from cars, there are a certain class of those video clips that are very restricted access because, you know, a lot of these are clips where very near misses with pedestrians, for example, and there's only a very limited few members of the team that are allowed to look at those, analyze those, and then work on software updates, you know, or do annotation with those clips. But the people that they talk to is this is not ready to be a robo taxi, and I think it's going to be a long time before it is.
It's hard.
Yeah.
I don't know why it's so hard for them to.
Waymo has a hard time with it too.
Yeah, Waymos get stuck all the time. Where are we? I don't know.
Yeah.
And they've had a bunch of weird issues recently with Waymo. It's hard. It's not an easy thing. Remember, you have the context of your entire life in your brain while you're driving. Cars don't have that.
Yeah.
You can train them on like, hey, this is what this picture means. Here's, you know, if this, then that. This is a lot. It's far more difficult to sort of take. I don't think people realize like the cognitive load that your brain has while you're driving, even like little itty bitty things that you are not conscious of that make you a better driver than a full self-driving car.
Have you driven the Rolls-Royce Spectre yet?
No, I drove. What's the last thing I drove? With Rolls-Royce, I don't know. It was like
Ghost?
Five. Yeah, the Ghost, that's what it was. It was during COVID, so I was just driving Rolls-Royce Ghost. I went up to, Mount Diablo, and I was just driving the road, like just me by myself.
For a big, heavy, luxury sedan, it's actually a surprise, especially the Black Badge. It's a surprisingly good car to drive.
It's really nice, and then it has the little stars, and I actually quite enjoyed it. I would be a driver for a very rich jerk in this car.
Well, Rolls-Royce has just launched, I have driven the Spectre. I had about a half hour with it a couple years ago at BMW Test Fest, and amazing car. If you've got, you know, $500,000 to spend on an electric coupe, go for a Spectre. It's fantastic. There's now a Series 2 Spectre. Rolls-Royce does this from time to time. You know, they will do updates and bump the series up. So the Spectre Series 2 is out now. And they have increased the range of it by 18%. So it's now rated at 390 miles of range on the WLTP cycle in Europe. Wow. So that's probably about 320, 330.
That's still good.
Yeah, which is, considering this is a big, heavy, powerful car.
This is you getting picked up on your country estate and then going 30 miles into the city to be dropped off at the ballet.
Yeah. It's also the most powerful Rolls-Royce they've ever launched, delivering 500 kilowatts, which is about 670 horsepower when it's in the infinity mode.
Ooh.
Yes, infinity mode. So if you're looking for the highest end of high-end luxury EVs, Rolls has got you covered with the Spectre Series 2.
Now with more range.
Yeah.
You know?
I'm assuming
if that's what was keeping you from buying the Spectre, you're like, oh, I don't know. It's a lot of money for that much range. Oh, you know what? 18% more, boom.
I'm guessing they probably pulled in some of the updates from the Noia class, some of the updated motor technology, power electronics, batteries. EV sales. Everybody figured, when the tax credits went away last fall, EV sales were just going to collapse, and they did collapse for several months.
Because they raised, they went up. A few months, weeks or months before. So yeah.
So you had a pull ahead of sales in the fourth quarter and the first quarter of this year, right up until the end of February, and then I don't know, something happened at the end of February, and fuel prices started to go up, and all of a sudden people started looking around and said, oh wow. $6 a gallon, $7 a gallon for gas, or even $5 a gallon in Michigan for regular. What can I do about that? Oh, there's EVs that are a lot less expensive.
I called it. I said you can't talk about EV sales until like March.
Yes, and that's exactly when it happened. You nailed it. You nailed it.
I know how numbers work.
So I
got the base level of how the numbers and sales of cars work. Base level.
So
please clap.
A lot of the manufacturers are only reporting quarterly sales right now, but there's still some that are reporting monthly sales, like Hyundai and Kia and Subaru, for example. And so the Hyundai Ioniq 5, their best-selling EV, so far year to date, sales are up 16% compared to the first 5 months. So through the end of May of 2026, 16% better sales than they were in the first 5 months of 2025.
Wow. I bought one of those. So
yeah.
I guess you're welcome, Hyundai.
So you contributed to that.
There we go. Look at me.
With your own
Finally,
money.
Finally, I contributed to capitalist society. Finally.
Ioniq 6 sales are down because they've actually discontinued that, except for the 6N for the North American market. So they're in a sell down period. So not going to talk about those.
They were sold. People didn't like the way it looked. Let's just be frank.
Yeah,
it drove wonderfully.
Yeah,
it's a wonderful EV if you are happy with the way it looks, and I think most people were not.
Yeah. And the Ioniq 9, a three-row crossover, which is still right behind
tailgating us.
It has not broken down yet. It's
they're
still
not
there.
Tailgating
yeah,
us.
They're right behind us. Those, it's not really a fair comparison because they just started sales in May of last year. But so far this year, they've sold 4,001. It was 302 last year through the end of May. But yeah. That was like 2 weeks of sales last year.
Yeah, it's not really. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not fair. Like 7 million% up. I'm like, you just started making something. Don't tell me you're making 7 million more percent.
But Kia also, EV9 sales are way up. From May year to date for the EV9, 5,736 compared to 4,025 last year. EV6 sales are down a little bit, but the EV9 is more than making up for that. And then Subaru, the Solterra, Subaru now has three EVs on the market. They have the Solterra, the Trail Seeker, which is the wagon, essentially a wagon version of the Solterra, and the Uncharted, which is the coupe, shorter coupe version, basically their rebadged version of the Toyota CHR. Solterra sales are down a little bit year to date, down 7.6%, but Trail Seeker doing well to start. They've literally just started sales in April, and they are up. They've sold 1,483 so far, and then 1,792 Uncharted's in the first 2 months. So total EV sales for Subaru are actually up about 40%.
Which Subaru is, it's not a Ford. It's not a, it's a little, it's higher than Mazda, but lower than everyone else.
Yeah.
They're in this weird little sweet spot. And of course, all Subaru people love all Subarus. That is our way. The Trail Seeker has that's the wagon, right?
Yeah.
That's why that was doing so well.
Yeah. I mean, the Trail Seeker is basically what the Outback used to be, but it's electric. So it's an electric if you like the old Outback, as opposed to the new current generation model, which
is still a really good car.
Yeah, it's still a good car.
It just
depends on what you think of the design.
Which, again, it's a Subaru. No one's ever bought a Subaru because it's pretty.
That is true. Although, I do like the look of the Trail Seeker.
Yeah.
I like the design of the Trail Seeker. So EV sales, for a lot of brands are actually up this year because people recognize that, hey, you know, when fuel prices are up, these things actually make sense. And, you know, I think, I haven't looked at used EV sales, but I think, those are going to be up significantly.
Yeah. Someone sent me a link. It was like the weekend. It was yesterday. So it was the weekend. And someone sent me a link about used EV sales because we were talking about used EVs on Blue Sky and had charts and information. And I just replied, don't make me look at charts on my day off. but it did sound, it did look like, yeah, EV, it's the dealerships are having problems keeping used EVs in their inventory. I know that they kept emailing us about us bringing back our Ioniq 5 early because they wanted to be able to sell it. The used EV market, I think, is doing good. I think they're doing all right.
And then last thing, the Toyota Corolla Cross pickup. This thing has been spotted, where is it here? It's been spotted testing in Brazil.
Let me pass this big truck.
Okay. For sure.
It's like one giant truck on this long highway, and I'm passing it right now.
So, up to the back of the doors, it looks just like any other Corolla Cross that we have on the market today.
Oh, cool. It's like
it's got a pickup bed on the back.
It looks like hey, remember the Santa Cruz? Well, now Toyota's making one.
So, it looks like this might be Toyota's answer to the Ford Maverick. And they
sell more than Hyundai did because it's Toyota. Toyota people.
Well, and I'll bet you Toyota launches it with a hybrid and perhaps only as a hybrid.
I think
that's the biggest mistake that Hyundai made with the Santa Cruz. They never put the hybrid in there. Because the Santa Cruz is basically a Tucson with a pickup bed. And you can get a Tucson hybrid or a plug-in hybrid. They should have put that in the Santa Cruz.
It should have just come out. Well, I don't know. Plug-in hybrids always seem like they're doing well, but they're really not. Electric vehicles outsell PHEVs.
Yeah, but hybrids do really well.
People love a hybrid because they're like, gas is really high, and I would really like a hybrid because, I don't want to spend so much for gas. And, hybrid, it meets that without having to plug it in or learn things. Yeah. Charging stations.
That Prelude, driving that Prelude around, it's on performance tires. I was not babying it. I got 38 miles per gallon with that thing.
Damn.
Yeah. See? So there you go. So that's all the stuff we've got for right now. I did earlier record.
Let's talk about the Slate thing I did.
Oh, okay. Tell us about that.
Okay. So the Slate truck doesn't have a modem. So I reached out to Slate and I was like, hey, tell me a little bit more about, decision not to put the modem in the vehicle. I'm assuming it's cost. And then there is a companion app, and will you be using that app to sell data to third parties? Automakers, they get your data, they sell it to third parties. GM got in a lot of trouble for this because the FTC in California both said, hey, you didn't give people, the correct amount of information about how much data you were selling when you told them to agree to this. So they got in some trouble. 5 years, they can't sell data. So I was curious, it's a new startup. You want to get revenue somewhere. So would Slate be selling the data from this companion app that attaches to the truck? You can set up the charging, everything, climate controls, a bunch of other stuff, diagnostic service. Will it be saving? And no. And then there's like a whole paragraph of Slate, we believe in, our customers are not, we're not here to sell data. Essentially Slate wants to sell you accessories. They want to sell you wraps. They want to sell you extra thing, to make it into an SUV, make it into, get it lifted, add a Bluetooth speaker. They want to sell all that. The data, they're just like, no, we're not going to sell data. They'll still be collecting data. Based on, and that'll be for diagnostics, for service, for stuff like, regular car stuff that you kind of need for an EV. But you don't even need to use the phone to drive the car. You can leave your phone at home. If you want to drive a Slate,
they won't get any data if you do that.
Yeah, they won't get any data, but, occasionally you go out and you can do something to probably update them in case they're, diagnostics. And especially when the car is new, every car has problems. But it was a... it was pretty eye-opening. And I talked to EFF, the Electronic... Frontier Foundation, about it. And they were like, wow, this is what we like to see. And this is great because, you know, it's very much... This is, you know, especially in the world of fewer and fewer expectations for privacy, this company is like, hey, yeah, we're going to be collecting stuff, but we're not going to be selling it to insurance brokers. We're not going to sell it to, you know, for ads, because you always go to Circle K or you always go to Walmart or you always go to, they're not going to do that. That all said, me and the EFF person who I talked to, that doesn't mean that'll last forever, because privacy policies, especially in the tech world, change constantly.
The first thing you read, if you actually read a privacy policy, this is subject to change at any time, yes, without notice.
Now, so Slate, you know, the current CEO, former Amazon. So right now they're saying, you know, we're not going to sell this data. Will that change? We don't know. Will the CEO, like, in 2 years say, you know what, maybe we do want to get a little extra money out of these vehicles and sell this data and people have to opt in? Maybe they'll get a new CEO. Maybe they'll get acquired. Maybe they'll, you know, they'll have an IPO. There's all these different things. I mean, Google, when they launched, was like, hey, we're not going to just let people pay for ranking.
Right up until they started letting people pay for ranking.
Right up until they let people pay for ranking. 23andMe was, you know, once it went to the bank. And then, of course, if Slate crashes and burns after 5 years, 2 years, 1 year, what happens to that data? That's something that happened to 23andMe when they went into bankruptcy. States were actually telling people, delete your accounts, because we don't know where this data is going to end up if, you know, this company is in bankruptcy. So it's a good thing, and hopefully it continues to stay a good thing. I would like to think that other automakers are sort of looking at this, you know, small company that seems to has caught the attention of weird nerds like myself. And, you know, I the idea that it, you know, that there's no modem in the car, it makes me very happy. The idea that they're not selling my data makes me very happy. I have an Ioniq 5. I know what the deal is. I know how data is bought and processed and shared and anonymized and not anonymized. And I would rather, if you can opt out of most of that, I would like to. And I think Slate is doing that, and we'll see if that's a thing that'll get people to buy the car. I mean, for me and, you know, privacy nerds, maybe, you know, if you need a car and you're like, I want an EV and I don't really want it tracking me. Cool. But is that a huge swath of the buying public? I don't know, but it's still a good thing for now.
Again, because there's no modem built into the car, all you got to do is just not connect your phone.
You don't have to take your phone with it. And I asked Slate, I'm like, do we still have to take your phone with you to drive the car? They're like, no, leave your phone at home. You can do all the, you go, you can
do, you know, charge, are they going to have a, are they going to have like a traditional manual key?
I think it's like sticks, it's like goes into something.
Okay.
Yeah. I was always kind of like, wait, how does this key work? Because it slides into something. I don't know if it's a charger or if you need it needs to slide in. I mean, if I had a manual key like my BRZ, that'd be pretty cool. You just turn it, it just doesn't, like, you don't have the vroom, vroom, vroom.
Yeah. All right. Anything else?
No, that's it.
Okay. Well, Teddy and Alvin and Simon and Tootsie say so long for now. Got a couple more things coming up after this, so keep watching. I've got a segment with Nick Miles talking a bit more about the history of Operation Frodo and what we're doing here. And then Nicole recorded a couple of interviews last week when she went to IHS. She talked about her visit to IHS to see the crash test of the Mazda CX-5, but she recorded a couple of interviews while she was there. She talked with Joe Nolan, who is the chief operating officer of IHS, and Jennifer Morrison from Mazda, who is their chief safety strategy officer, or director of safety strategy, something like that. And you'll hear that when you listen through to that part. So keep stay tuned for that. That's all coming up next. But for now, see ya.
Bye from. Still in Nebraska. Right?
Somewhere,
bye from Nebraska.
Somewhere in Nebraska.
Nebraska, such a wide state.
It is a huge, huge state.
But I can see rain in the forecast. So
yeah, well, you can see it over there to the
it's
north.
It's going
to
get us.
Yeah.
It's going to get us.
But yeah, I mean, this is the thing that especially Europeans don't get about America, you know, driving across America. And this is one of the reasons why we're doing this trip right now with EVs, you know, transporting these dogs. You know, we usually do this with gas vehicles, but or hybrids, but we're doing this with EVs to show that, yeah, it can be done. You know, this is a huge, huge country.
There's so much country in this country. I've driven across this country three times? I don't know, I've driven coast to coast twice, and then to Kansas once, so. It's hella big.
It is big. And, you know, we're not flying over this. Usually, I mean, in my case, most of the time when I'm here, I'm up there somewhere in an aluminum or aluminum tube, yeah. You know, we're driving it today and, you know, stopping and charging, and it's all good. So we're having fun. Bye.
Bye.
All right. I'm here with my good friend, Nick Miles. We are at this Walmart on a gray, drizzly morning here in Omaha. Quite a bit different from yesterday. But Nick, you are the founder of Operation Frodo. Tell us all, what is Operation Frodo?
So, and I have excused my voice because I lost my voice yesterday. Operation Frodo is really a movement of dogs from areas where there's too many to areas where there's very little. So, we are car lovers. We mostly are car journalists by trade or PR people, and we also love dogs, so why not combine what we do for a living with our passion? And we're helping, with the help of automotive companies, take beagles, especially beagles who are in excess in the Midwest, and move them west. The charity which owns Operation Frodo is Animal Rescue Rigs, and we founded that to try and help rescues actually build out their vehicle fleet without having to use the money they raise to rescue dogs to actually use it to buy vehicles. So it's really just an excuse to spend time with dogs.
and who can use another excuse to spend more time with dogs? You have a few dogs in your household. Yeah. How many do you have?
I have six currently. Two of those are rescue beagles from the first Operation Frodo. The little Lord Frodo himself, who's become quite a little fat man, and his sister Galadriel, we call her Gala for short. They are definitely the loudest animals in our house, but it's an amazing tale. We went to get one dog and ended up with two. We brought four back, and we had quite a tragic time bringing them back. Minus 70 degrees, there was people dying on the roads because the conditions were so tragic. And people were worried about our safety. There were six original volunteers that helped do this the first time. And when we got home, Christmas Eve, started getting phone calls, and everyone was like, when are we gonna do it next year? So guess what? Operation Frodo was born, and we do it every year, at least once a year. It seems to be two or three times a year. Kind of proud that Sam, you put together the first Operation Frodo EV. We're doing it electric. Just why not add another level of complexity into rescuing dogs?
Hey, you know, if you're going to do something, you might as well make it a little bit challenging. You know, challenge yourself. And so that's what we're doing here.
It's fun, exciting. One of our biggest challenges this time is to see if all the dogs actually make it, because we have a pretty poor record of people adopting dogs throughout the
And to be clear, you know, the dogs always make it to a home. It's not like we ever lost any. They just didn't necessarily end up in the homes that was originally anticipated.
Yeah, the intended homes aren't always the ones they end up going to. We've had, I think, three dogs which were intended to go one place and actually ended up going another place because they were adopted by either a person on the drive, Paul Eisenstein, or by an associate of someone on the drive. The last time, Andy Hedrick came back, flew all the way back to Portland, went and picked up a dog from Lee Asher at the Asher House, drove it all the way back to Michigan to a forever home because he just wanted to make sure it found its right person.
Yeah, well, that's great to hear, and I am honored to be a part of this effort. This is now my third Operation Frodo. I've done the last two December trips, helped you guys organize this one, get the EVs, get charging support from EVgo, and get the routes figured out.
And this is a great thing to be part of. You know,
we should also mention that there is car companies involved, is Cadillac, Kia, Hyundai, and Lucid this time around, as well as EVgo. And of course, the rescues, Bass and Beagle Rescue of the Heartland, they are the initiating rescue, Cascade Beagle Rescue, Utah Beagle Rescue, and Seattle Beagle Rescue. And we have other rescues now who are talking to us who kind of want to get involved, not just beagles. We have Rancho Coastal Humane Society in San Diego are talking to us, and Midwest Brew, who are in Chicago. So the names, the words getting out there, the fact that we've been on MSN's homepage a bunch of times, and we're getting hundreds of millions of views, thanks to other journalists like you, Sam. So it's starting to get, and it's a little bit like the Witch's Cauldron. It's a bubbling.
it's a movement. We're gonna make it happen. We're gonna make sure that as many dogs have loving homes as possible.
Absolutely. You can always go to animalrescuerigs.com, RIGS.com. Find out more, donate, help, volunteer. We're always willing for anybody, if it's scrubbing cages, driving, or just cuddling dogs, which is my professional. That's what I cuddle.
Hey, I mean, everybody's got to have a use in the world.
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you, Nick.
Thanks, Sam.
Yep. So first, just tell me your name and your title.
So my name is Joe Nolan. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for IHS Hilti.
And how long have you been doing this?
I started working here in 1992.
92? That was the year I got married. You've been here for a while.
Yeah.
So what is the mission of the IHS? What are you trying to do?
So the mission of the Institute, the entire organization, which was founded in 1959, was to reduce harm on the nation's highways. The mission statement has varied over time, but this facility, which was built in 1992, was designed specifically to have an outsized influence on vehicle design for safety. And so we have our crash lab and outdoor test tracks and photography equipment, all of this thing so we can do our own research, not the government, not the automakers, and understand what changes in vehicles would result in a safety benefit for real world people. And then we would start to run those tests and use the power of consumer information to convince the auto industry to make changes to those vehicles. It's been a fantastic success.
So it was interesting when I first thought of like crash tests, what I always in my head until I started really listening to you guys and today, it's just to tell me as a consumer, well, you don't want to buy car A because it crashed terribly and you want to buy car B. And I always looked at it very much as just, it's a purchase decision thing to help with a purchase decision, which it absolutely does. People are going to gravitate towards safer cars. But you guys are really using this as a tool to encourage automakers. Like if your car's not doing well, you need to look at these things to make it safer because it's safer for the public. The public's more likely to buy them. So you really are influencing what the automotive industry is doing for safety.
Yeah, absolutely. Our very first test program caught the auto industry a little bit unawares because...
And when was that? When was the
version? This was in 1995.
95, okay.
And in that period, the people that did crash testing were the government, regulatory crash tests, and then the automakers. And they did it in their own laboratories. And that was the whole ecosystem of crash testing. And all of a sudden, this insurer group shows up and they say, hey, we're going to get into the crash testing business too. And I mean, no judgment intended, but they just didn't know what to make of us. They're like, what's going on with insurance companies crash testing cars? Like, what's this all about?
Right.
And it was a bit of a challenge the first number of years. We had to demonstrate that we had the technical expertise, the epidemiology, the research, and the field data, the field data to justify the crashes that we were simulating in the laboratory and to press the case that these are important for you to incorporate into your car. And so that took a little while.
Like how long from the time you guys show up and you're the new kids on the block?
Yeah,
and no one knows, right? No one knows what to make of you. To suddenly an automaker saying, hey, okay, we saw what you did here. We need that information to help us make our car better. How many years would you say it took for them to take you seriously?
So it was about 5 years,
yeah?
Maybe seven. and you know, some were more polite about it than the others. You know, with a standard statement that says our vehicle meets or exceeds all safety standards.
Correct. Right.
But then we introduced our second test, and the data for that one was rock solid. It was our side impact test.
Oh, okay.
And it just happened to be work that we were doing, looking at what's killing and injuring people in side impact crashes, and what could be done for self protection in the car, i.e., what can the car do to help better protect you? And the one thing that really jumped out from the field accident data was the outcome for a passenger car, which was the bulk of the fleet, was significantly worse when the striking vehicle was a light truck, pickup truck, or an SUV. And this was when SUVs started getting out of the truck for hunters to go out, you know, off-road to people movers. And the results were dramatic, and the risks were highly increased. They're heavier vehicles, their body structure is higher, so they skip the really important load-carrying sections on the side of a car.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Which is the door sill.
They ride over it,
right above it. And so that puts all the impact onto the B-pillar, that center post. And we were just crushing it, some cars, like all the way into the center line of the car.
Wow.
And then to add insult to injury, because they also had tall hoods.
Okay.
It looks like the driver's head comes out the window and hits the hood of the car, the truck.
Yeah.
But it's really, from a physics standpoint, it's the other way around. The occupant's head is inertia, keeps it there.
Oh,
and then the hood of the vehicle comes in and actually hits direct head strikes.
Wow.
And in our display area, we actually have one of those old R&D tests.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look on the striking vehicle, it happens to be an old Ford Explorer, there's a dent in it.
That, and that's from the dummy's head. So a test like that comes out. It's a really damning test on how automakers are just building their cars. And they say, I got to change.
Well, and it wasn't an indictment of the car. What it is pointing out was that the fleet is changing. And so cars didn't change. But they had to, because the partners that might hit them are becoming more aggressive. And so cars had to up their game more than they had been for years and years and years, because the fleet was changing.
So as you're doing that then, like, the fleet changing caused this test to be more important than it was probably when cars were more sedans, right? Because sedans are less likely to do that to each other than a sedan and a truck. So that kind of thing could happen again and again and again as the industry changes. How hard is it for you guys to look at things and figure out, okay, vehicles have changed in design this way or that way, and we now have to come up with a new test to accommodate the new world that we're in?
It's not as complicated, I think, as you think, because we're constantly circling back to the field data.
Okay.
And saying, what's out there? What's injuring and killing people? And one of the more recent times where we asked that very question, hey, the fleet might change radically, was electric vehicles.
Did that pose significant challenges to your testing?
So EVs are in general, at least 1,000 pounds, not more.
They're heavier. Yeah.
So right off the get-go, mass disparity is a problem for the lighter vehicle. Just always is. Doesn't matter what powertrain you've got. So right off the get-go, we're like, all right, we're going to be increasing some of the fleet incompatibility.
Right.
It was made worse by some of the early designs from automakers, where they said, hey, we've got a good idea. We're going to take our biggest SUV product, and we're going to electrify it, so it now rolls in at 8,000 or 9,000 pounds.
And like the trucks and stuff, I'd imagine. Giant electric truck. Oh, gosh.
Yeah, and the shame of it is that there was opportunity, because the lightest vehicles, if you look at just weight across the fleet, you're far better off bumping up the weight of the light vehicles a little bit to help even out the disparity.
So the weight difference isn't so great. I get you.
Yeah. And And so if all of the small vehicles were electrified, that actually would help normalize the weight distribution.
Okay.
But we didn't do that. We went the other way. So that's one we looked at. But what we learned was, if anything, EVs, because the batteries typically are mounted way down low, at the floor level, the structure, the crash structure to support those is also really low. So they actually became more car-like.
Oh, because all that weight.
All that structure's
I see it. Okay,
lower.
Yeah.
And so other than the mass disparity issue, there wasn't really anything new for us to address.
Interesting.
So we looked, we investigated, and we said, nah, nothing to see here.
That's cool. So if you had to look, you're looking through a crystal ball, mm-hmm. and you're trying to imagine what's going to happen in the future. What do you think the next big challenge that you guys are going to have with cars in terms of testing? And like, you know, we had EVs, we have trucks that are bigger now than instead of all the small cars. Do you see something coming down the line that's going to be a challenge coming up that you're going to have to rethink things and figure it out?
One of the long-term challenges is to be more comprehensive in our testing. And crash dummies, while we report them being really sophisticated, they're directional. They're not reliable in any what's called off-axis loading. So if it's a frontal crash test dummy, and you're, let's say, at a 10 or 15 degree type of angle or motion, you start to lose fidelity to a real human.
Okay.
And the same for side impact. They're designed for a perpendicular impact.
Yeah.
But what if it's a 45 degree impact? Then you can start getting.
Okay.
And so, let alone just the limit, the limitations of the dummies that exist. And if you look at the locus of people that are out there, there's big people, tall people, wide people, narrow people. And then on top of that, they sit in all sorts of different seating configurations. Some people like to recline more. Some like to be, you know, less reclined. That's an infinite number of crash tests.
Which is an expensive proposition. To buy an infinite number of vehicles is not realistic.
but it is realistic in the computer-aided modeling world.
So that will start to have a bigger impact as you try to, as computers can figure out some of that stuff to model it.
Yep, and that's our long-term vision from a crash-worthiness standpoint, is that we will develop ultimately a suite of conditions that an automaker would test in simulation, and then we would just randomly choose one and be able to do physical audits to keep people, keep them honest.
Keep them honest, yeah.
To the extent that we can. You know, eventually, they're going to be simulating actual human body models.
Wow.
Which is, instead of trying to use a surrogate already, which is a dummy, they're using an actual human body model, and they're improving like crazy.
Wow.
And you can get so much more granularity out of knowing what organs are being stressed, and if the heart and the aorta and the different.
So it's going to be, instead of a physical dummy, it's going to be how much you can make that more and more human, give every last detail about what my insides are, not just how it's hitting me on the outside of my body and the forces anymore.
And we'll be much better at injury risk prediction.
Mm-hmm.
Because right now we've got to make this leap where you've got a mechanical device that you then tie to some biomechanical corridors.
Yeah.
But it's very limited. And even if you add 100 sensors, you know, that's not going to capture
everything threat, in the human body. Muscle. Yeah. How far away do you think that is?
I think we're already starting now in our brand new whiplash test.
Okay.
Where the automakers are now allowed to submit their simulation results.
Okay.
And this is, it's a test that simulates a front and to rear.
Gotcha.
Whiplash, lower severity crash.
Yeah.
And so the only thing the automaker has to model is the seat and then the dummy in it. So they're modeling the dummy in the seat in this condition.
Right.
And that's, you know, that's a baby step. But it is us accepting simulation, and we're developing the procedures to have a third party, due to intellectual property issues. Right. Have a third party be the interlocutor who gets in. They do the evaluation with non-disclosures and all that stuff.
Right, right, right.
They feed us back summary results, obviously, if we ran the test. So that process is just starting now. But I would hope in 10 years we were least we're getting some additional results. And I would love to see it in frontal crashes where you've got just such diversity in age,
yeah,
and stature and bone mineral density. We're an aging population.
So this can get down to a much more granular level.
Absolutely.
Than what the crash test dummies, despite being $250,000 a pop.
Yep.
There are limitations. That's awesome.
But it's financially, like, for us to embark on becoming a computer modeling powerhouse is extraordinarily expensive, mm-hmm. and it's completely, like, out of our wheelhouse.
So yeah.
I'm definitely going to want to do partnerships with that.
But that's next.
I think it's cool. Yeah.
Amazing. Thank you very much. That was perfect. That was exactly...
Love you.
your handler.
Yes. Yes.
Okay, so first say your name and your title for me, please.
I am Jennifer Morrison, and I am the Director of Vehicle Safety Strategy at Mazda.
And we are here at the IIHS. I was told I say that too quickly, and everyone thinks I'm dropping one I, so enunciation is important.
Sometimes I just say the Insurance Institute or the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety if
okay.
you want to go the long way.
Okay, that works.
Those
too.
Those all helpful.
So we were here to get to see something that I've always wanted to see, which was a car get crashed. And I love you guys in Mazda, but we just watched your car get crashed, and it was kind of awesome.
It was, wasn't it?
So what made you decide to bring us crew of journalists and influencers down here to see this?
I love that question. It has been years in the making. So I joined Mazda 8 years ago, and I had been to Crash Test before because I had a previous career with NHTSA and NTSB. But I've been joining these crash tests with our engineering team, and we have been winning all of these awards, the top safety picks, the top safety pick pluses. Even going back a decade ago, 2016, 2017, we were doing really well, but we really just weren't doing a good job of telling people about it. So as I started to attend more of the tests and just kind of look around, like, this place is gorgeous. This is science and engineering at its best. I have to bring this to the masses. I have to be part of that. So over the past few years, I've been working with our wonderful partners within Mazda's marketing and PR teams and our engineers to get the buy-in, to establish and use our great relationships with the media. And we brought our president and CEO, Tom Donnelly, here a couple of years ago. We brought in our marketing team.
Did they all get to see a car get crashed?
They all got to see a car get
crashed. Excellent.
Tom came for the CX-90. Our marketing team came for the CX-70. And this is the third version of that. We're like, we need to bring in media. Of course, everyone was a little nervous about it at first. Like, are you sure you're going to do
well? Why were they nervous about it?
Right. Like, you know, anything can happen in testing.
Okay.
They're like, are you sure you must be so confident? But as you saw today, we're not speculating on how the vehicle did.
Right.
It's really not even all about necessarily Mazda here. This is about automotive safety advancement at large, what the Insurance Institute is doing for the industry, what drives us collectively as an industry, whether that's IHS or a car company, how we work together, how this is done, everything from the crash avoidance sensors, which you guys got to see demonstrated today, the crash test dummies that are $250,000.
The numbers involved
the
in
numbers
were insane.
Cool.
I was
it's
like, each cool. of those dummies is $250,000. I knew they were going to be expensive, but mm-hmm. that's a lot. And then you're taking it and you're basically throwing it at a thing to possibly get smashed to bits in the process.
This has been such a cool day for me. It's a long time coming. There were 31, 32 members of the media, maybe a few more that were here. I think almost 40 members of the media.
It was a big crew of people.
Right, and different parts of media, too. We've got lifestyle. We've mm-hmm. got content creators for social media. We've got our traditional reporters. We've got podcasters. It's been incredible. I'm gonna turn into a puddle at the end of this day, but I'm trying to enjoy it and sit in every moment.
I thought it was really, because I always see videos. I've seen a million videos of crash test, and it's one thing to see it in video. When you see it in person, and I videoed it again and posted it, you cannot get how impressive, in a good and a bad way, it is to see and hear that crash. You literally feel it in your chest when that hits. and you get a sense of how violent that is. But knowing that this very violent thing is happening so that if it ever, God forbid, happens to you in a car, they've done all these little things to try to make it safer and better for you. They had an example as we were walking around, and I forgot which vehicle it was, but when they were first doing the side impact, mm-hmm. and another OEM had not changed their car recently, it just, bam, went right through. But you guys had already reacted to things because you knew it was coming, because they communicate with you.
They're
it's never
great
a great surprise. So it's not like you know exactly what's happening, but they give you, hey, we're kind of leaning this direction.
Right. It's very data-driven. So that's where there's a lot of alignment between the automotive industry, certainly the OEMs that are listening, and IHS. So they're looking at the data that's coming in from insurance claims. That they have, no one else has. They mm-hmm. have a huge network of data coming in from insurance claims. So they know what types of accidents people are getting into, how injured people are in accidents. And what we have from the automotive industry, we also have vehicle telematics data now. So we can also see from our vehicles what kind of crashes people are getting into. They have the injury data. We have more of the facts of the crash. And this is allowing us all to be smarter and study things and oftentimes walk a very parallel path. In the case of today, rear seat safety, right? The vehicle, the moderate front overlap test adds that rear dummy. The reason that dummy is there is because we were seeing in the data that there's still a lot of injuries in the rear seat. Mm-hmm. We needed to make sure that we were having more energy absorption taken into consideration in the rear seat. And that means rear row airbags and that are built into the seat belts and pretensioners, and just overall good geometry mm-hmm. for passengers and occupants in the rear seat. And that side impact one was another yep. example that you saw that was a few years ago, where the right. CX-5 was the only vehicle to be able to do good in that test, the good rating right at the introduction of mm-hmm. the test, because we were again walking that same path. We were seeing injuries, inside impacts that we thought we could mitigate by having a stronger structure, everything from the types of metals that we use to the type of welding that is used in manufacturing, and then, of course, the airbags and the seatbelts. All of that is a whole system, and we were thinking about that as they were thinking about it, so we didn't have to make any design changes. We knew that too.
You were already there. How right. often does it happen? Like, that was something you were already on track with, knowing that was an issue.
Right.
Seeing it on your own when they said, hey, we're going to make this part of our testing because we're seeing an issue too. How often is it that you guys are sort of made aware of something that maybe you didn't think of? Like, hey, we're going to start testing this. And you think, oh, wait.
Yeah.
Maybe we need to look at that more closely.
That happens. I have a good example of it.
Yeah.
Too. Right. So right now, IHS, the next crash test they're thinking about improving is their rear impact, their whiplash crash test.
Okay.
So that is done on a sled. They just use the seat because rear impact and whiplash is really about the seat. That's what absorbs the energy.
Okay.
Right. So there was a whiplash test that was in the books for a while. There's going to be a new version of that. And Mazda hadn't, we'd run the tests ourselves. We thought we were doing pretty well, but IHS is going to increase the speed of that test.
Oh, okay.
That's going to be difficult. And we had the setting of the dummy position. It really also is like how people drive and sit in a vehicle in Japan, maybe versus the United States.
Oh, okay.
So we had been sitting our dummy a bit further back in the seat, so closer to the seat, more engaged in the seat.
Okay.
Whereas the set position for the dummy in IHS's protocol now, it's a little bit further forward. So there's more opportunity there for
your whole body to move back. And
So they did test our CX-50 and they published that rating, and it did get a poor rating.
Okay.
So it's we both understand that rear impact is important. We've both studied it, but their methodology was a little different than ours.
Okay.
Their speeds were a little different than ours. So we are going to be needing to reconsider that and think about our seat structure, think about how we're setting dummies in seat for testing, make some countermeasures, make some adjustments.
Do you view that when that happens and you get your vehicle tested, it's a new thing, you haven't had tested before, and you're like, crud.
Yeah.
It didn't quite do what we didn't. Is your initial instinct like, oh, they found something? Like, what's your feeling when you say that? Or do you really truly view it as an opportunity?
My first reaction is usually like, oh, that's not good. I don't like seeing that red. I don't like seeing the red rating. I want all green. I'm all green. Yeah, I really want, as most overachievers,
right.
I want all the best ratings. But it is an opportunity because
that means that they're not doing that for no reason. They're doing that because they saw something in their insurance data, and rear impacts are awful. They don't necessarily have as many fatalities, but mm-hmm. it's a terrible injury. It's neck injury, it's back injury. So if they're seeing that in the insurance data and they're very transparent with why and what they're doing, then obviously they have a reason. So we listen to them, and then I can use that in my conversations with our engineering teams and saying, listen, there's really a good reason for this. And oftentimes it's not huge changes. There's logical, manageable change mm-hmm. that can happen. And if that results in someone not getting a terrible neck injury, then it's worth the momentary pain of the red
the
rating,
red
the red four. I'll take it. I think I mean, as an engineer too, like I think all problems are fixable. So I just see it as a problem I can fix.
A problem you can fix. Excellent. That's perfect. Thank you so much for your time. That was easy.
Awesome.
There we go.